Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is October the 19th of 2016. Halloween month continues here on Weekly Manga Recap. What's up, everybody? It's Y-Ron Rolo T. We're going to talk about disease outbreak manga. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing good, Nick. I was a little tired this week. I ran a half marathon over this weekend. It was a Hershey half marathon. I'm very proud to have run it. It's been a lot of fun. But I have a bit of a story to tell regarding it, if you'll indulge me for a brief moment.
Okay.
I need to preface this story by saying it has a happy ending.
Okay, good.
So you may feel horrible about who I am and the kind of person I could be, but understand it's all okay because there's a good ending to this all. So when I run, I like to keep like a mantra in my head, like some phrase or idea that helps keep you pushing forward when you've really kind of hit your limit. You're just exhausted. You don't want to run anymore. You call it forth and you keep running. You start running again. If you slow down, you just go for it. And I've used things like haiku quotes or just, you know, like inspirational things or just like stuff that makes me want to do more. So I'm running the race and two older women pass me and they have pinned to their back a picture. It's a picture of a baby. And it has like a trachea in its mouth, clearly like a newborn baby, days old, if anything. And it's got the tube going into its mouth. And over the picture, they both have a message that says, "We're running for Austin." I'm like, wow, that's really special. I am not going to lose to that dying baby. And that became my sole motivation for the rest of the race, is that I was not going to lose to that dying baby. So every time they passed me, those two old ladies, I didn't look at them anymore like they were old ladies. To me, they were that dying baby on a pair of robot legs just propelling it forward. Not good robot legs. Like, clearly he was, like, back there with me in this pack, so they were kind of, like, discount robot legs, like me made out of, like, partial trash cans or something. But I refused to lose to that baby. So every time I got tired, I'm like, all right, I got to slow down. I got to pause here. They'd go by, and I'm like, this fucking baby's
not going to... Fuck those bitches and their robo-baby.
That dying baby's not going to get one over on me! Not on Rolo T! And I'd pick up the pace again, I'd pass it, and I'd be like, yeah! Fuck that baby! The good news is that the baby survived, I assume. Like, they didn't make an announcement, but I didn't hear anything to the contrary, so the baby's fine.
As long as I don't hear that it's dead.
Yeah, then, you know, it's a good story all around. Feel good story, you know? I didn't let a baby defeat me.
And the baby lived.
Yeah, the baby's probably fine. Babies don't die. That'd be cruel and sad.
Elsewhere in Pennsylvania, they're at this baby's deathbed. Oh, if only we'd beaten that one jerkwad.
If only we placed just one spot.
One spot.
They wouldn't have had to kill our baby. I'm like, wow, that was a weird qualifier for this.
What a weird condition.
They're like, they had that in here? They had a qualifier that if you don't manage
They've
to finish...
They've got the baby ready for life-saving surgery. Sorry, ma'am, I see that you failed to beat some geeky podcast host in the half marathon, so your insurance can no longer cover this procedure.
We don't cover losers, ma'am. They don't make insurance for that.
Yes, they do. Really? It's called insurance.
Yeah, like, isn't that all insurance for people who lose things?
Yeah, but they're for winners in life.
Yeah.
What about life insurance? Shut up.
But you don't
losers
need
can't argue semantics with me.
You don't need that, though, because your baby's dead. You're the worst doctor ever.
That's exactly what life insurance is for. Look, I only talk with winners.
Yeah, what's this loser doing still talking to me? Get out of my office.
Just die like that other loser.
My baby? No. But yeah, I mean, yeah, your baby too.
Oh, yes, I'm sure your baby was a loser too.
Oh, man, that was a morbid start to this podcast.
Just getting in the mood for Halloween month.
Yeah, exactly.
With laughing at dying children. That's what Halloween's all about, right?
Yeah, no, it's good. We got it. We're right in the mood now.
Anyway, straight from dying children to other dying people.
Yeah, it's like this story almost led itself perfectly.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. What you don't know is that the child actually suffered from a blood explosion disease. Or whatever this disease is supposed to be. This manga that we are covering for this week is called Emerging. It is about a new devastating virus emerging in Japan and the chaos that ensues as a result of it. It's a different type of manga that we're covering for Halloween month. Because although we have definitely covered, you know, super virus type series during October before, this one is much more, I'm not sure if realistic is the right term, but framed more realistically than the series that we did cover for it.
It's definitely grounded.
It's very much a sort of what-if scenario, actually. What if, you know, like, the next Ebola virus suddenly emerged in Japan as opposed to, you know, a third world country? And how would people deal with it? How would the public react to it? How would the government handle it? Although not all of those things are completely fully explored. Uh-huh. Let's just get into this. One day, this one worker just has a disease, and while he's waiting on the street, he just dies from it. His body bloats up because his body is hemorrhaging so much blood internally, and he goes into spasms, which cause his blood to spray everywhere. And the disease thus spreads because his infected blood has gotten on the people surrounding him. And shortly after that occurs, more cases start cropping up, especially from the people that have gotten this blood on them. And we follow a couple of different doctors as they're trying to deal with this outbreak. That essentially sums the whole thing up. Honestly, it's a pretty straightforward, simple series, but it's down to really the tone and the attitude that the series has that makes it unique. Honestly, it's kind of politically driven.
It's surprising. It's also, as you mentioned, it's very grounded, and it's not a horror movie in the way you, I guess, maybe traditionally think of horror. It's more macabre than just horror, because it deals with, like, a legitimate kind of issue. It's not symbolic of anything. This isn't, like, a zombie outbreak that's meant to be symbolic of, you know, a highly contagious, easily transferable plague. It's literally just a super virus has come out. We weren't prepared for it, and it's taking out people left and right, and they don't know how to cure it. And that's a very simple way to go about it. It's not a particularly long series. There's not a whole lot of characters to keep track of. There's essentially, like, four you have to really, I guess five you really have to remember. And
there's,
that's about
well,
it.
There's the two doctors,
the girl,
there's
her boyfriend,
then the director of the research team.
Yeah, and I guess there's also the guy at the pharmaceutical company. You could also
consider. There's some supporting. Well, there's figureheads. Yeah. Let's say
there's just a couple there, but it's tough to say exactly in phrases because I feel like the way I'm going to explain it is going to make it sound like I hated it or didn't like it. It's a boring series. But I think it's just because there's not much thrill to it. It doesn't do anything absurd or crazy. Even the disease itself, which causes people to bloat up, bleed blood, and then cough up like a geyser of blood before almost exploding, even that isn't all that crazy or disturbing because it's not really dwelled upon too heavily. And I say this after, like, essentially, what, 2 years ago reading Gaio, where that was the whole thing, is people ballooning up and then exploding. So even, like, kind of the actual deaths of this series aren't, like, you know, they're not, like, body horror even. It's a little gross at times, but there's nothing in that that's particularly, like, vile, but it is what it's talking about that I think helps make this series interesting to read. You know, just the idea that it's hanging upon what is, in many ways, a very legitimate concern for humanity. The idea, like, you know, we continue to get better and better medicine, so of course, viruses, germs, things like that are also evolving to get stronger as it goes along. So that whole thing of what's going to take out humanity, is it going to be a super virus? It basically hits upon that. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and you know, I was expecting, honestly, that it would get a little bit more into some nitty-gritty stuff, or that there would be some more twists and turns here and there. But really, what happens is they come across this disease. There's a bit of a freak out over it because of how potent it is. More cases start to break out. So they take samples to a research institute to try and figure out what it is. It turns out it's a new virus. More outbreaks occur more rapidly. A national panic breaks out over it. Things get a bit quarantined off, and people are all sent taken to this one main hospital. And right when you're thinking that things are really going to start kicking up, they discover the cure. And the series ends.
Yeah, it's not a long... This is two volumes long, and most of the chapters are only like 20 or so pages, like standard manga chapter length, so it's not like it's a whole lot to get through either. It's sort of interesting, too, because there's not even a lot of, like... you say there's not a lot of twists. Like, that's it, exactly. There's no, like, twist to this disease beyond that they realize it's airborne as well, and that, like, delays when it activates. But they're like, oh, wow.
It could be airborne.
Because they're like, this one person who was nowhere near this incident is now showing symptoms of the disease. But they hit this point where they're like, okay, because there's a female lead at the start of the series, at the series. The way the first chapter goes almost would make you think she's going to be the protagonist, because it focuses a lot on her, on this cut she has on her finger that she's got a band-aid over. And then she's present when the first victim dies and some of his blood gets on her, particularly where her cut is. The rest of the series is actually following her neighbor, who she sees as a big brother, and basically his fight to try to save her alongside another doctor and then find a cure for everybody. So there's no real twists in that dynamic or relationship. There's some elements that come up along the way, but it's not like there's a point where they're like, holy crap, these people's skin is dissolving so fast. There's nothing more to it than that. It's just a really bad disease to have. They're like, oh, wow, we don't have the stuff here. Like, Japan decided it was safer not to have a quarantine level 4 facility, you know, and then they open up the quarantine level 4 and they're like, all right, we found the cure. It's like, it's not like a big revelation or anything like that. The biggest revelation is at the end when they're like, yeah, you know, it's just going to keep evolving. Like, that's just what diseases do. Like, maybe it'll come back and fuck us up again one day. And that's it. But at the same time, I think I like partly because it's simple. And I also really like that its main relationship that it's trying to tell isn't a romantic one. The main doctor...
There is a romantic relationship in it that is central to the story. But yeah, Onotera is the main doctor character. Akari is the girl. And it's, yeah, his main focus is, I have to save her. But it's strictly for platonic reasons, yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I always really like the movie Jeepers Creepers solely because that was another horror movie where the main characters were brother and sister. I was like, that's kind of nice. It's almost always like, let's have a romantic couple in there. It's like, no. It's kind of scary when you're like, oh, my brother's been... I think Jeepers Creepers used to rip off their skin and wear it, and he was a flying bug man. I don't remember the plot very well, but I just remember appreciating that it was a different sort of relationship than you normally get in that, and I like that in this, that it was you know, a guy trying to save someone that he considered a little sister. Yeah. You know, not actually related, but he considered.
Yeah, too bad the brother was Justin Long, but, you know, we're going
to there's really not much more to say about this series, unfortunately.
Well, I've got a few things to say about it.
Okay.
People in this series are stupid. Okay, so let's go through some of the stupid things that happened in this. First off, Akari insists on going on this date with her becoming boyfriend, Oshima, even though she's feeling sick. But you know what? That's, you know, typical, like, teenager. Oh, no, I've got to, you know, go on this date. You know, I don't care if I'm a little sick. That's fine. But then there's Onotera. This guy is weird. He is a trained doctor. And, he's got kind of a nervous attitude. There's a bit early on where, cause they're all wearing, hazmat suits in order to examine the first body. And Onotera's gloves split open. And so they're like, oh shit, you know, what if I've got a cut and the blood can infect me? And he starts to just have a panic attack in the middle of this room. And Sekiguchi, the other main doctor, shouts at him to calm him down. And it's like, okay, we get it. You know, you're the rookie. You know, Sekiguchi's seen things that'll turn you white, boy. But Onotera is the more naive one. I get that. Even so, after they send the sample to Mori, who is the head of this research team, and she examines it, because they're worried that it's going to be Ebola, and that there's an Ebola outbreak in Japan, which would be, you know, chaos. And so they're just sitting around in Sekiguchi's apartment waiting for a call back, and Mori calls them and says, we tested it against every viral strain that we could think of. Ebola, SARS, AIDS, every single virus. Every result came back negative. Which, of course, means it's a new virus. And Onotera's response is to go, oh, thank God, it's not Ebola! It's not Ebola, yes! And Sekiguchi's like, oh my God, you mean it's a new virus? It's like, why doesn't Onotera realize that? That's what negative matches against everything means. That is literally the only conclusion you could draw.
She's like, yes, it's not any of those. That must mean it's nothing. Yeah, it doesn't exist. My friend's going to be okay.
When Sekiguchi and him had this conversation in the car while they were on their way to Tokyo, where he was talking about, I think that this could be even worse than Ebola. Like... Like, you could have had the same reaction if Mori had said, it's not Ebola, and Onotera's like, yes! And then Sekiguchi's like, wait, what exactly do you mean by that? And then she says, it doesn't match anything. Instead, she goes, it doesn't match anything, and Onotera's still like, it's not Ebola!
Yay!
You freaking idiot. You're a doctor!
He does lack any real competency, because I'm even trying to think of a moment where he shines, and he really does. Like, the closest they have is when they're like, oh, well, we're gonna take a couple of these patients to America, and Akari suggested to be one of them. And he's like, you can't do that, she'll die. They're like, okay, then you go instead, cause you've been here the entire time, you would know the most about this. And he doesn't go, that's when they, like, figure it out. Like,
he's prepared to go.
Yeah, he's prepared to go, but that's when they figure out, like, oh, hey, I think we know what the cure is. And he doesn't really do anything. Like, I think he's the one.
Because Mori and Sekiguchi go into this, you know, super special research lab in order to try and harvest a vaccine to save the day. And it turns out that Mori has actually contracted the virus. And so she falls ill in the middle of it and she can't continue. She's, you know, too physically weak. So at that moment, you would think, okay, Onotera is going to replace her and then he and Sekiguchi are going to work together and do this and save the day. Instead, no, she just lies there dying, and she's like, okay, now do this next. And Sekiguchi does everything, and he saves the day single-handedly, while Onotera is sitting by like, I hope Akari doesn't die.
And Mori somehow survived that! They made such a big deal! Afterwards, they make such a big deal, like, how could this have happened so quickly? She's not responding. I'm like, oh wow, like, she died at the end. And then they do like a 3 months later cut, and they just get a call from her, and she's like, I'm going to a different country now to work on new diseases! Cause she's like a germ otaku, basically. And that's like, you're
she's
just like...
She's a unique character. I thought that she was the most memorable part of this whole thing.
She's the only kind of weird thing in this series. Cause no one else has a personality.
Yeah, she's a virus otaku, and she has literally a poster of Ebola in her office because she loves super viruses and loves researching them and finding out about them. And when she finds out they've got a new disease, she's actually kind of morbidly excited about it. And so she's working with this team to try and find a cure. And eventually they kind of are figuring it out. And she's like, oh man, I can't believe this. And they're like, we're trying to save humanity here. Are you like, okay. Yeah, but...
Well, it's also kind of weird, because she actually starts to develop a crush on Sakaguchi solely because he was able to figure out a cure for the disease, too. Like, she starts having feelings for him almost in a way, like, because he's stronger than the disease and figured it out. Now she's like, I'm kind of crushing on him a little bit. And Sakaguchi's such, like, a fucking white bread, no-thrills person. He's just like, yes, phone call, feelings of infatuation. Goodbye. Good job, fellow doctor man. Now I'm back to do other human things.
I imagine all of his dialogue to be in, you know, George Clooney voice. You know, it's like, doctor, yes, let us cure the disease. Oh no, Mori has fallen ill with the disease. I must carry on by myself. Come, doctors, let's go. Yes, doctor. And yeah, like a lot of the characters don't leave much of an impact, honestly. You've got very kind of straw man characters in a lot of cases. There are a couple of guys who are actually part of like research branch of the government or something like that. And the very top of it is very concerned with not letting information about the virus get out because it'll cause the stocks to tumble. His subordinate is a bit less corrupt than him, but he's still like, yeah, we shouldn't let some of this news get out because what if we're wrong? And then that'll just cause more of a panic for no reason. You know, and then Onotera decides to go WikiLeaks on it.
Was that Onotera? I thought it was someone else.
I think it was Onotera who did it, because he was really resentful, wasn't he?
Was it actually Onotera, or was it just someone who looked like him? Because that
I don't know.
Onotera reacts to the news coming out as though it was a surprise to him.
That's a good point. I don't know. Some guy with glasses who looks like Onotera.
I really wish I could have more to say about this, because I feel like this
I do have a little bit, a little bit more to say.
Carry on, Nick.
It seems as though the author of the series, Hokazono Masaya, has a very bleak outlook on Japan's organization with disease control. Because a central plot element of the story is the fact that Japan is woefully unprepared to deal with this super virus, because they make a specific point, and this is actually true, that they have this super virus research center. It's a level 4 research center, which does not get used. It's not used because the public doesn't like the idea of super viruses being experimented on and researched within the country. And so the disapproval is so high that they have actually shut the research center down, and they only use it when this tremendous emergency situation comes up, and only like because they absolutely know that they can use it to harvest the cure. They don't have like measures to isolate people who have the disease from the rest of the world. They don't have means to shut down communications with the outside world and so on and so forth and prevent it from spreading. And so a lot of this seems like a "it could happen here" story, because this virus emerges and a whole lot of the story is just focusing on, yeah, if this actually happened, we'd be kind of screwed, guys.
I mean, that is like a legitimate fear, though, is that, and I've always just kind of had to operate under the assumption that better minds than myself are taking care of this. But it is an idea of like, yeah, you know, as science continues to evolve and get better, then naturally its opposition is going to get stronger as well. And that has been a concern that, you know, by over-vaccination, we're creating super viruses, essentially. You know, but there's, it's a larger argument than what that is simplifying it to. But it still is a concern about the idea of a virus that's strong enough that it can wipe out huge portions of us very quickly. So
there's also a point that's made early on, which is that in Japan, we take medicine in such a carefree manner that we've become hardened against the idea of being infected and stuff. People don't care anymore. And then, of course, it turns out that the cure for the disease is discovered because a teenage couple won't stop making out when one of them is sick. So
basically, that was a weird way to do it, too.
I mean, I'm not going to say it comes out of nowhere, but it is kind of a lame sort of resolution for the whole thing. Oshima, who is Akari's sort of boyfriend, and they definitely become a couple at the end of the series, decides to break into this area that they've got, into this hospital where they're holding all the patients, and he kisses her despite the fact that she is on her deathbed, because he's like, "I will die with you!" And they, of course, security, of course, discovers him, and Otero's like, "Wait, you're her friend." But he says, "So, yeah, what, have you been around her in the last several days?" And they eventually figure out, oh, he actually kissed her on the mouth several days ago, and he's not exhibiting any of the symptoms when everyone else has started exhibiting symptoms by this point, which means that he must have immunity to the virus, which means that we can actually, you know, take samples from his blood and find a cure for this. And then they do.
Yeah. Like, it's like, okay. I mean, I get it in the sense that it all logically works. It's just, it's not a cliche, because I don't think I've seen this done before, but it just feels kind of hammy when it's like, the way we discovered how to defeat this awful disease was when true love conquered all. Like, it's like, all right, I get it. But it's still not, like, something that I despise. I feel like even with this, it sounds like we may be pointing out what we disliked or the dumber parts of the series, but I really don't feel like this series was overall bad or dumb or anything like that. I just feel like it was unremarkable in a lot of ways.
It feels like there's unrealized potential to it, honestly. We actually got recommended a couple of other virus outbreak manga, which I don't want us to do because then it'll feel, you know, monotonous for this month. But I do have to wonder if, you know, they would have done some things better or in a more remarkable manner. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting series, and I'm glad that we did read it because it feels unique in terms of its approach to this subject matter. But yeah, I would have liked if it were a little bit more extraordinary in some cases.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. That's gonna do it. It's only been like 10 minutes, Nick. Do you want to talk about Air Gear again?
No.
Okay.
Let's do the recap portion, Weekly Manga Recap, in which nobody has a horrible, incurable disease.
Except this guy.
Except for Asta, who's got broken arm cursed disease.
That's getting fixed.
Black Clover, page 82. Forest of Witches.
Are we not doing Amalgam of Distortion?
Oh, yeah, you're right. I guess he also has an incurable disease. You're right. I'm sorry. I'm so used to starting with Black Clover now. Amalgam of Distortion, chapter 2. Not chapter one. What is it called? Dans Macabre. Or, I don't know. I don't even know what language that's from. Oh, well. I like the cover page that we got for this chapter. The image of our hero, Rokumichi, before and after the experiment on different sides of the railroad tracks. That's a cool visual.
I wish that the chapter title was Dank Macabre, and it was just a bunch of dank memes for this chapter.
What?
Like, it's just like, you need to control the bones in your body for Harambe.
Much neck, such long, wow. So, last time, our hero managed to gain control of his super bone growth experiment disease, but Eshu was determined to kill him anyway because he had been turned into a monster despite being able to return to his human form. Eshu reiterates that he must kill him. He thinks that he will continue to mutate into Starring Skeleton and eventually lose control of himself, and so he can't risk that. He'll turn into a monster. And he even points out, hey, you know, look at the area around you. You're a monster now. I can't let you leave this place. Look at the damage you've already caused. Eventually you're going to lose control and you're going to hurt somebody. We have a little bit of an info dump because he says, I'm with MI6, basically. I'm with this government agency you don't know about kind of thing. But before Eshu can actually strike the finishing blow, suddenly they're distracted by boobs as this half-naked girl suddenly comes in. Alright, if this girl's one of the other experiments, they seemed to, pay a great amount of attention to the type of underwear she was wearing.
As lacy and suggestive as possible.
Shouldn't she just be naked if we're going to have her experiment on? Nah. Okay, well, what kind of underwear should we put her in? Let's get some of that Victoria's Secret, you know, lacy little number.
String bikini, like, that seems impractical for any reason. Except
then
that
again,
you're a pervert.
Considering the head scientist from in the last chat. I really like her appearance here, though, because she just shows up. And they're, of course, distracted by her appearance. And we see Rokumichi speaking with her, and then suddenly her head approaching his in a close-up. But then we pan out and see that she didn't walk close to him and lean in. Her neck just extended out.
It's terrifying, but I love the way that in these three panels, essentially three panels that make it up, where he's talking and you see her face getting closer and closer, you see his reaction getting more horrified with each panel as she's presumably stretching her neck out further.
But you could also read it as he's just embarrassed because she's getting close to him. Because, you know, he looks like he's blushing. But, you know, it's an attractive woman in underwear who's suddenly leaning in towards him. But then you see that, yeah, the reaction was terror because her neck stretched out like a freaking boa constrictor. Of bone. So she is one of the other experiments. Eshu says that she is a failed experiment. Rokumichi is essentially the only success they know of course. And she is going insane. He essentially says she's dead and she is only speaking based off of memories. That she has before. The demon cells are controlling her, and the Ayakashi cells, rather, are controlling her, and they're just tracing her memories. And she's saying, you know, some weird things that aren't exactly related to the situation, like, oh, I'm glad that you like this senpai, and stuff like that. And Eshu says, yeah, she's gonna die in a few days anyway, but she's a danger to us right now. And this, you know, this is what's going to happen to you. So, and there's no avoiding it, that's why I've got to kill it. Eshu continues to fight with her. He takes two katana out and attaches them at the hilt into a double sword, which is something that I've been waiting to happen ever since I saw The Phantom Menace when I was 9 years old. I love double swords. They're so stupid. Not two swords connected by a chain or something like that. Specifically, two swords stuck together. It's got to be two swords stuck together. Like Darth Maul's double lightsaber.
But see, what it separates is Darth Maul's double lightsaber was two lightsabers put together. It was already one complete thing. This is two swords that he connects together and makes the double sword.
Which means that they're two swords and one sword. It's so cool, Chris.
Oh, what if it could shoot bullets too, like it was a gun double sword?
Yeah, he connects them and then he pulls them back so they're just a double barrel shotgun. Oh, God. Rokumichi interferes in the fight as when he realizes that the girl is crying. And he blocks Eishu's attacks. And Eishu actually realizes that he's using his powers willingly. He is actually manipulating his bones while maintaining his sanity. So he's actually seemingly manipulating the cells rather than the cells manipulating him. And Rokumichi shouts at Eishu by saying, look, you shouldn't have to kill her. I mean, aren't you actually paying attention to what she's saying? Because she's talking about this guy that she has a crush on, that she's looking forward to going out with. She's remembering speaking to her mother about it and being all happy. And Rokumichi says she's got someone waiting at home for her, which, of course, matches the reason why he was able to gain control over his cells, is because he's got a girl waiting for him back home. And finally, he finishes off this
whole
thing.
That's right. He does have a girlfriend at a girl he likes at the start of the series. I forgot about that.
Yeah. And he finishes off this rant by saying, "Who are you?" Doesn't. But suddenly, the girl actually deliberately impales herself. It looks like. I'm not sure if she actually does it on purpose. Yeah, she does.
Yeah, he says.
She impales herself deliberately on the one of the bones sticking out of Rokumichi's elbow. And Eishu is, of course, shocked by this. And the girl says, thank you, and don't give up just yet, okay?
I don't know how she says that when her mouth is full of bones.
It hurts a lot.
Demon cells.
I should have thought this through.
It's like that bit at the end of Hot Fuzz. Great movie.
It's a great
movie. Eishu says, I'll be there to end you the moment you let those demon cells get the better of you. I will make it my personal mission. For now, you may live. And Rokumichi then passes out. Eishu gets in contact with his boss via a cell phone. The boss makes a note that there is actually a way that Rokumichi could return to normal again.
Well, he actually had the phone on the whole time.
Yeah, transmitting the entire conversation.
So I guess that was possibly part of their plan to be from the very beginning.
Possibly. Maybe this was all a test.
Possibly, maybe.
Maybe Eishu was actually hoping that Rokumichi would prove himself and be allowed to live. And nice chapter. Not quite, definitely not as good as the first chapter, in my opinion, but it's nice that we're getting a feeling of what this, kind of the themes of this story are about. Which, for a series about bone demon monsters, the power of love is kind of an unexpectedly huge part of it.
I liked it a lot. I thought this was a really good chapter. I just like how unrelenting this chapter was with this girl as the victim, because every time she's just getting like slashed. I mean, there's literally a panel where there's like four knives in her face, and she's just like, "Thanks, you senpai. I'm glad you like it."
She's crying and her eyes are looking in different directions.
Yeah, and it's like kind of disturbing imagery, but like the more you hear from her, like when she's like, "No, don't cry, mommy, it's okay, I'm happy, thank you." And it's all while she's, you know, trying to kill them and also being killed at the same time. Like, that's kind of fucking hard-hitting. I like that the series didn't, like, stray away from that or give it, like, a dumb story. It's kind of like a... like, I feel like they actually told a story with this character that was kind of nice. You know, it could have just been generic. And it was done in a clever way, where it's, she's actually, like, reliving, I guess, what was the most important memories right before this happened. So, I like this chapter a lot. I thought it was effective, and I like the hint that there is more to come.
Good.
Now we do
Black Clover. Now we'll do Black Clover. Okay, so, last time, of course, everyone in the Black Bulls except for Yami was trying to find a cure for Asta's curse arms. So, Noelle has gotten Fenrir to take her to this shack where we meet three characters that were introduced in the Black Clover novel.
Yeah!
If you want to know who these characters are, you have to read Unmasked, the side story that that's not available in English.
I was going to say, like, yeah, you know, just maybe this
way we can also if you want to know why Kira is not dead, just check out the Black Clover novel.
Yeah, I thought it's an interesting move. I hope it's not a common theme. Like, I guess if you're a huge fan
of Black Clover, know who Zara is, just check out the Black Clover novel.
I get if you were, like, a big Black Clover fan, maybe it's kind of cool, but as a casual reader, it is annoying when it's like, oh, hey, we're just introducing these characters from a side piece thing in here. So it's both good and bad. If they do it more and more, it just becomes more and more annoying. But in this case, if this is like a one-off thing and these characters maybe keep appearing after this, then I'm like, okay, I could get into it. But overall, yeah, I'm not a big fan, especially when it's something that's not available in English. I know English Jump has absolutely no control over that.
Yeah.
But it's something that it's like, it's unfortunate that these are characters who have personalities and aspects to them that I just don't get because I had no way to actually read this, essentially.
It's not so much, you know, the being unfamiliar with these characters as the fact that Noelle and Asta have met them before and are very familiar with them and have an established rapport with them that we never got to see develop, which is something that is unique to this story because it seems like everything that we've seen up to this point, aside from Noelle's interactions with her family, is all stuff that we've seen as it begins. Asta and Noelle don't have, like, old friends, you know? it's just not something that we've seen before this point, and it's really awkward when it comes out of nowhere for the entire first half of the chapter is a conversation between characters that already know each other. It's annoying.
I'm actually kind of curious. Did Tabata write that story?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he had input on, because it would be kind of curious if he was just like, oh, I like those three characters they had in it, and I'm going to add those into my story.
I love this guy who keeps on taking his clothes off.
I'm going to call him Gray. Well, I'm getting a message from somebody. Oh, okay.
I've already got a character named Gray. Right.
Oh, yeah. I guess that's the other reason why I shouldn't do that.
Well, I guess I could have her disguise herself as him. Oh, boy. They end up going back with Noelle and Fenrir to talk with Asta, who is doing lots of squats to just train his lower body because Asta can't sit still for one fucking second. Hyperactive little shit.
I think if he does, he dies. He's like a hummingbird. Like, if they ever stop beating their wings, their heart explodes.
But we don't really see anything that happens. They just kind of pick him up and leave, and are going somewhere as we cut elsewhere to the, land of the witches that Vanessa went into in the last chapter. And we just kind of see people in the world that apparently they're just all witches with witch hats.
This is interesting. I I guess this is just one of those things that over time, especially since I've played D&D and other like tabletop and like MMOs with fantasy settings where like warlocks and witches are a class, mm-hmm. I've lost all gender association with those two terms. They're gender neutral to me, but it seems that this is actually literally just on the idea that only women are witches, because there are only women that we see. And the only time people talk about men almost seem to be like in a derogatory sense, like the mascara kind of sense. Like, you went out with a man from the human world? So I would not be shocked if it turns out the captain from the blue birds or whatever, the thorn captain who hates men. I wouldn't be shocked if she's from here too.
I guess that would make sense, yeah. Vanessa is speaking
That's my god-awful prediction of the week. I'm gonna come up with that's Rollo T's rockin'
Stone Cold Lock of the Century
of the week.
Of the week.
Yeah, I'm just gonna steal Aqua Teen Hunger Force's gimmick.
Oh, God. Vanessa is speaking with a peacock lady. I mean, just peacock lady. Seriously. Her dress is peacock feathers, and mm-hmm. she's got, like, peacock eyelash markings. She's scolding her over stuff like, ever since you left the forest, my plan has become something far from perfect. And if you master your thread magic, as I told you, you'll be able to control destiny itself. Which I guess makes sense. Like, threads of fate.
I would like to see if they actually extrapolate upon that into, like, that being what her power is. It'd be kind of cool.
But you let that man tempt you. A mere human man when we are perfect witches. How could you? Aren't you ashamed? And Vanessa, very quietly just destroys the room that they're in.
It seems like it's her who destroys the room. Like
I guess you're right, because she like sends out this shockwave, and Vanessa just stands there as it blows by her and destroys the wall beyond her.
Yeah, because it's the woman saying,
and then she's like, "Oh,
perfect room."
Well, it's your room, lady.
Yeah,
you wrecked it.
Presumably, you built it. You were like, "These walls will never be destroyed by me, but my powers are so perfect they must be able to destroy any wall." Oh, no.
Can I create a room that I cannot perfectly destroy? I'm getting the strong sense that imperfection is this woman's gimmick. She's going to just, like, watch a guy try and throw a football to himself and trip over his own feet. How imperfect!
Throw a towel over into the air, catch it with one hand.
Spit his gum out and try and bat at someone, but instead just get stuck to his fingers. Imperfect!
And she murders you. Like, she takes a huge axe and chops you in half. Imperfect! You're like, you're gonna kill a lot of people if these are the standards you're holding them to.
Curtis Axel just walks in. Imperfect!
Rolling three bowling balls down an alley and getting three different strikes, but she's like, you only got two and a spare! Perfect!
Oh, man. Vanessa makes a demand, which is, if you want me to come back, I have one condition. Teach me the ancient dispelling magic. So...
That's a sound effect.
Okay. Guess we'll find out more next time.
That's the sound effect of her eye, apparently. Hoo-woo!
That is true. Hoo-woo!
Ooh, new prediction. She's half owl.
That's the twist. She's got peacock theme, but she's actually an owl.
She's trying to trick everybody.
I'm a different kind of bird.
I was deceiving you. See, that's the thing. If I were in fucking... If I were in a manga, I'm like the villain in a villain, like a manga villain group, and I have fire powers, I'm walking around like covered in fucking Eskimo clothes and bullshit. I want everyone to be like, this dude's got ice powers. And then I'm like, gotcha bitches, foosh! Fire attack! Like, I'm just disguised, like I'm covered in fucking like antlers and shit. Like, no, I have nature powers. I gotcha, it's fire powers, foosh!
It's like that piece of advice when you're playing D&D. If you're playing a wizard, they're going to target you if you look like a wizard. So dress up like you're, kind of a lightly armored warrior. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly whip out the spells. But everyone's a wizard, seemingly, in Black Clover, whoever fights. So, yeah.
It's there you go. It's also like that Peter Griffin strategy of, like, see, they're going to be looking for army dudes when he's in Vietnam in a clown costume.
Oh, God.
All right. Before
that shit, we're still funny. Fairy tale.
Yeah, so let's move on. Fairy tale chapter 406.
Why is there a naked?
Actually, I think now I guess she is nude. I can't tell if that's supposed to be like her chest bone up here or if that's like the collar of a shirt. It's a very pronounced like chest bone, if that is the case. Sternum, I guess. But, I don't know. So last time, as you recall, Makarov.
Okay,
is,
guys. He doesn't come back this chapter. So.
A new record.
If he makes it through next chapter without coming back, we're going to have a new world record for Fairy Tail. I'm getting pumped, guys.
All right. So. Makarov.
Never coming
died.
Back.
He died. And everyone is very sad. They have a bunch of flashbacks with Mavis naming him and crying because she wasn't able to do it. And then Laxus shows up and he's like, stand up. There's still
dad was
a, to fight.
My granddad was kind of a dick, so don't worry, you guys.
I mean, I'm also kind of a dick, but it's okay.
But I'm going in the opposite direction he was, so.
Everyone raised their hands, and now I'm not a dick no more. They then cut away essentially to Xerath, like, saying, like, oh, yeah, they succeeded. You know, they wiped out about 80%. They're more competent than I would have expected. But Irene clarifies, it did not affect the remaining members of the 12. Which at this point I'm like, who fucking cares? Who's left? It's just Natsu's evil brother and fucking August. No one else matters. And Irene, I guess, she's technically one of the 12 too. So it's those three. Just point out that those three are alive. I don't care if fucking Lassum is still out there or if Wall Point 4 is still fucking out there somewhere. They're all worthless to me at this point.
I would have loved if, like, the 20% of the remaining army came up on Fairy Tail while they were going, Makarov, and Urza was bowing and stuff to his frozen corpse, and they were just like,
they're like,
your guy's gotcha. Gonna cry over every single one of your members who dies. I mean, you know, okay.
Well, yeah, we'll just kill you all one at a time. Wait for you to start crying over that person dying. it cuts.
They like and eventually get bored and start timing it out. They're killing off Levy's partners one by one. Okay, yeah, let's give them like an hour and see if they stop crying before then. Before we off the other one. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, alright, that one's looking like he's gonna do something. there we
yeah,
go.
Gotcha.
There's the tears again.
Brad, you timed that so fucking
friendship
well.
Friendship forever. Friendship forever. They are Fairy Tale. Or they, you know, were, you know.
Yeah.
Before we killed them.
Good job, team. I guess we get to be the new members of the Spriggan 12, right? Unless we're reviving.
I mean, we did our jobs way better than they did.
Are we reviving fucking Bradman again to do nothing? Hey, he killed, well, I think mostly only his own men, but he was really dangerous
he did,
for a little bit.
He did mortally infect Gajeel.
Yes.
Before Irene ruined that.
So we cut over to Natsu being very angry still. And Gray, who's considering that Luvi is dead basically because of Natsu and has to stop him. So they're having a fight. And that's really all that needs to be said. It's essentially like 10 pages of them fighting each other. And there's some interesting action to it, but it ultimately is just like, you know, punch, 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 attack, attack. And it ends with them doing like the powered up fist punching. And before they connect, Urza stops in the middle of them and blocks both of their punches with her bare hands and just looks at them with tears and says, how can you be fighting each other? Because they don't know yet that Makarov is dead.
Why aren't you guys all crying with me over Makarov being dead? And Elfman? Oh, there goes Lisanna.
I'm irritated instead, too.
I should really get over there.
Cry with me!
You know, this chapter, maybe on another day of the week, might have been more effective, but considering that My Hero Academia tackled this exact same topic with, you know, also involving peoples with fires, fire and ice powers, it was done in a much more effective way, having someone come in and basically be like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
Yeah.
It had a lot more weight to it. It's not bad. It makes sense, but it's also one of those things where I just can't shake the thought like that Makarov's just going to come back in a week anyway.
So. I'm hoping it's going to be just 2 weeks. It's two more weeks, and then we'll have the new world record for a character being dead in Fairy Tail. Brood Wars! Show Kageki no Soma, Chapter 187, Bursting Menchikatsu. Soma,
ooh, wait,
is
Nick,
first.
Don't you mean Food Wars Spooky Geki no Soma?
No, I don't.
Geki no Soma? Come on!
I'm surprised you didn't just do Food Wars, honestly.
I did that last week. Think of it, Food Wars. Hold on, I don't think I get it.
You may be surprised to learn this, but I try and ignore your terrible Halloween puns.
Nick, normally it's Food Wars Shokugeki no Soma, but this time, in the spirit of Halloween month, I called it Food Wars Spookugeki no Soma.
Why wouldn't it be Spookugeki?
Well, that's when you're saying it really fast. But when you sound it out phonetically, then you're like, well, that's not an actual pun, because spooky doesn't rhyme with shoku. But when you say it fast enough, like Food Wars Spookugeki no Soma, it all comes together perfectly. I can't tell if you're frozen or if you're just really angry.
Imperfect!
Okay. Oh, no! Chat likes it. I'll need you next.
Soma puts his bear meat dish out. He introduces it as being the best meat dish that he is capable of having. Nasan, Leonora's husband, asks for a napkin so that he can eat the dish barehanded. And he bites into it along with the two twins. And clothes ripping apart, flying everywhere. It tastes really good. Soma explains his dish. The girls freak out over it. It's good. There's a couple of good little bits here and there, but, I know that this is, you know, part one of three of this same act for the next several chapters, so I'm gonna try and not freak out over how you know, silly and fun the reactions are. I like, actually, the stuff that goes on, you know, when they're not directly reacting to the food. Like, how the twins are suddenly huge Soma fans, because they realize, wait a minute, you're the one who beat Big Sis Alice during the Fall Classic! Oh man, Dangerous and Wild Men are so hot!
I also like the little flashback they show. It's like one panel of when they were with Alice. And it's like Alice instructed them, and clearly they're just like grabbing on to fucking Kurokiba and like pulling on his face, and he doesn't have his bandana on, so he's just like the submitting. He's like, okay. And they're just literally like fucking toddlers grabbing onto his face and pulling.
And then I also like the bits where they give this formal introduction to themselves to Soma. I'm Bird, and this is my twin sister Sheila. This is a thesis we both wrote. Would you like to read it? And Google's like, what the fuck? He's Mr. Soma now, and I'm just Terranori.
I also like how Soma even comments. It's like, I know that. You introduced yourselves earlier. He's not an idiot.
Oh, God.
I also like that the Dean's son also has the...
He's so fucking ripped.
He also has the air of disrobing to him. So, like, he just has his shirt blow open after eating.
But, yeah, so everyone's like, all right, yeah, he's gonna do it. And Kubo's followers are like, he's gonna win, Yukio! got this match. And Cuckoo says, I had faith, young grasshopper.
Oh. He even has the Fu Manchu.
Stroke my imaginary beard.
He actually has the Fu Manchu in that panel. That's great.
But Soma isn't celebrating just yet because, he says, I'm not so sure as Hayama is presenting his dish. And as he unveils it, Soma declares this match hasn't been decided just yet. So, presumably we're going to find out what Hayama's dish was next time, and then hopefully there are going to be one or two twists after that point.
Well, they reveal it, I just can't tell what it is, because I don't know.
Like, whatever no clue.
They draw it's food. It looks like chicken nuggets, but I feel like...
It's not chicken nuggets.
Well, I'm saying, I guess bear nuggets. But I'm like, it has to... Hold on, Nick.
It's time for Rollo T's Stone Cold Lock of the Century of the Week.
Of the Week.
That dip? Honey mustard.
No, it's not.
Honey. Nick, what do bears like? They like honey. Two things, honey and mustard.
No, they don't. They like honey and everything.
They love honey and mustard. The only two things. It's going to happen.
They like honey and berries and fish and deer and...
I'm talking about cartoon...
They're omnivores, Chris.
I'm talking about cartoon bears, Nick.
What cartoon bear likes mustard? Save Yogi when he's stealing picnic baskets.
That's all I need, right?
smarter than the average prediction. Oh, boy.
Just wait, Nick. Just you wait.
And honestly, they look like chops to me.
Chops?
Like breaded pork chops, but with bear meat.
Well, I don't know what the thing to the sides are, because obviously that
must be it looks like it's two different types of.
I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Maybe two different types of meat dishes that go together. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. Next, we are gonna do My Hero Academia.
Or don't you mean My Hero Academ-ed? Yeah.
That's not nearly as bad as the last ones.
So you feel that it's improving.
I'm not saying
so this
that.
Was the best one yet.
Okay, improving implies goodness.
So, if the last one was like a 7 out of 10, okay. This one is a solid 9.5.
I mean, you're not applying negatives to these, so this scoring system is inaccurate.
So I'm getting perfect, is what you're saying. I'm becoming the best.
I'm just imagining you suddenly put a neon blue unitard and smirking after making a terrible play.
Maybe I will next week. Maybe that'll be my Halloween costume.
You will know that my Halloween puns are absolutely
perfect. Hold on. Let's go to Amazon.com.
And then you will know that my Halloween puns are absolutely boofect.
What is it, like a blue... It's not a leotard, that's something different. Unitard?
Unitard.
Is that the
wrestling
same?
Wrestling unitard.
Well, I guess I should put dude on there. Blue unitard dudes. I should search for that in Google.
Anyway, oh god, people who don't know 80s WWF are like, what the fuck are they talking about? My Hero Academia at number 111, Smoldering Start. So we actually get a flashback to the planning of the Provisional Hero License Exam. People in charge of the test discussing ideas what to do. And so the first one is, we'll throw these kids into this chaotic environment and see if they can keep their heads and take quick action. And then, yeah, after that, we'll do the same thing, but test their teamwork instead of their individual abilities. So they're like, okay, what exactly are we going to do in order to do this, however? We need to focus our evaluations on how well they collaborate and cooperate as teams. All Might had it all. Power with enough charm to win the people over. The gulf between him and the perennial runner-up was always huge. And now we're going to find someone that charismatic in anytime soon. So instead, teams must focus on, heroes must focus on team unity in order to fill the gap. Sound logic, I would say. But of course, we then cut back to the actual hero license exam where there was an evacuation rescue test going on, but then Gang Orca showed up with a group of stormtroopers. In order to act as the villains continuing on the terrorism attack in this scenario. So yeah, the heroes are going to have to multitask, and yeah, what are they going to do? And we actually even get a bit with the main tester, whose name escapes me at the moment, where they're like, yeah, we're going to maximize efficacy. I've got, you know, a bird's eye view, but I've also got 100 of my fellow Public Safety Commission members, each equipped with scoring manuals and comprehensive data on the 100 examinees. This is, like, a little bit too much information, honestly. Boy, how are they keeping up with all these heroes to score them? Well, I mean, I assumed they had cameras, you know, whatever.
I assumed superhero powers, probably.
Well, yeah, but, Ragdoll, her power is gone, so it's not available. You know that she would definitely be here for this if they needed it. Shindo, the earthquake guy, tries to direct traffic by saying, like, okay, you know, we've got to get the civilians to safety and move them from the villains quickly, so I'll hit them with shockwaves in order to not allow them to get close. He does start to take down some of the foot soldiers in the group. But then Gang Orca jumps up in front of him and goes too slow. And we're introduced to Gang Orca's quirk. Orquitas does whatever an orca can. But on drug.
I love that power. You know what I love, Nick? Because of how, like, fucking vast the superpower Wikia is, this is now going to have to become a power set on there. Someone's gonna have to create a new page for orca-related abilities. Like, orc-related powers. And this is gonna be the only motherfucker on that page.
Although I don't recall them actually using their sonar in order to paralyze their prey. Oh no. Can orca do that? That'd be pretty badass. But yeah, he sends out a shockwave that, that paralyzes Shindo. Then he quickly starts getting overrun by, some of the foot soldiers while he's paralyzed. But then, Todoroki interferes with a huge wave of ice. Ojiro is trying to help out, he shows up along with Ashido and says, yeah, we're shorthanded, and when we saw the villains, we came to back you up, and so there are, yeah, Asui and a few others are actually helping with the rescue efforts. So I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. So Ojiro is going to be one of the combat people in this stat? That's unexpected. You would think that he would go over to help. I don't know. I guess there's only so many things you can do with a tail.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll see some of that combat training advice come to effect. Because that was one of the things, you know, someone just pointed out, like, you just kind of fight the way I expect a guy with a tail to fight. God. Wind guy shows up. I'm going to memorize this guy's name eventually, I swear.
It's Gale Force, Nick, remember?
I know it's Gale Force, but I'm going to know it. Non-superhero name eventually.
You just gotta say Gale Force, Nick, because I perfected his name last week.
He starts to help out against Gang Orca, but he and Todoroki spot each other and start to distract each other. And, Yorashi, they say his name right there. he's being like, God, why do you have to be here? And Todoroki says, look, why don't you go help evacuate? Your quirk suited that. I'll, you know, hold these guys off. And Yorashi instead jumps in as well, and he fires a blast of wind at the same time that Todoroki unleashes a wave of fire, and the two attacks interfere. The heat from Todoroki's flame deflects the wind upwards, and the wind, of course, blows the fire away. And they're like, what the fuck are you doing? What the fuck are you doing?
I love Gamorka's expression.
Wonderful expression. It's this beautiful face, because I like how his eyes are the fake orca eyes. It makes him so much more expressive.
Yeah.
Because he's just like, what the fuck are these guys doing?
Yeah, he just has this glare, like, just constantly. But then, in this moment, he's like, like, it's just piqued his curiosity slightly. Like, what?
They start taking pot shots at each other. Yorashi's saying, I shouldn't be surprised by your attitude, because you're Endeavor's son. And Todoroki says, what the hell does my father have to do with this? The foot soldiers start shooting at them while they're distracting each other. But they still carry on with their argument, as Yorashi relates the tale of how, to me, heroes are all about bringing the heat. Their fiery souls inspire passion and hope in people. So it was a real letdown when I tried to get his autograph and he shoved me out of the way. I mean, okay. Real dick move, granted. But it's kind of a lame bit of personal motivation.
Yeah, I was expecting, like, his dad or, like, someone close to him needed saving, but Endeavor had already, like, done his job and, like, left, or something, like, just not like someone died, because we still get the sense Endeavor's a hero, but the sense that he didn't go out of his way after everything was safe, or something like that. And that once he saw those same cold eyes in Todoroki, it all kind of added up. As it is here, he's like, your dad was a dick, and you're a dick too.
Well, because then they show that Yorashi actually showed up when they, you know, announced at the entrance ceremony, and Yorashi tried to greet him, and Todoroki just went, move it. He's just focused on the entrance ceremony, didn't really get along with anyone. And so Yorashi's explanation is, you had those same eyes. Todoroki says, what the hell, get a grip, I'm not him. He's thinking to himself, he's just another Endeavor hater like so many others. When you say it like that, make it seem so much more lame, don't you? He's just an Endeavor hater, man. I can't let these haters get to me. I gotta shake them off.
I was about to say, like, he's like, I know what to do when things like this come on. Just shake it off. Shake it off. Like,
he just, I say you're too late. Go on too many dates. Except, no, I don't, because I'm Todoroki and I don't have a social life whatsoever.
Shake it off. Shake it off. Like, that's the only part he gets animated during.
Oh, man. At least that's what people say. But I can't make them stay, you know. So the hater's gonna hate.
So the Endeavor's gonna hate. Is gonna hurt.
Oh, man. The part of his personal decoration that you didn't see, the giant poster of Taylor Swift.
His T-Swizzle poster. It's on the inside of the door. That's why.
Oh, thank God that she dumped that loser Tom Hiddleston. You were so wrong for each other.
Loki with a goddess never work.
Todoroki just tries to stay focused on the test and ignore Yorashi, who's still harassing him, saying, you two are the only ones I'll never accept as true heroes, and that's it. But unfortunately, their attacks are still interfering with each other, even as Todoroki is trying to focus on Gang Orca. Todoroki realizes too late that the wind has blown his flames off course, but this time blown them towards the still paralyzed Shindo, who is helpless to defend himself. But then Deku manages to arrive on the scene, leaps in, and drags Shindo out of the way as he shouts out towards the two of them, what's the big idea? So it seems as though Deku is going to try and get these two back on course and get them to at least temporarily cooperate. Because that's what this is all about. It's about teamwork. Not just about between the schools, but amongst the heroes in general. So we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. This is an interesting chapter, at least.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to say about it, because it's really just to set up for the next chapter, but that's this issue we jump all over, really. Promised Neverland's chapter is titled Part 1, so...
Nick, don't you mean... And I want you to grade my puns from here on forward. They're all going to be on the scale from 1 to 10. Don't you mean the prom witched Neverland?
Negative 3. Okay.
Alright, so that's... good in comparison, or is zero the scale I should hope for, or like higher negative means you hated it more because
It wasn't as bad as Spookugeki no Soma, so.
Well, that was just brilliance.
No, it wasn't. Chapter 11, Traitor, Part 1. Emma is still freaking out over the possibility of a mole amongst the children who is betraying them. It's interesting because Ray is, like, trying to figure out reasons that they could suspect different ones, and he eventually points out, like, what about that one, Phil? But do you remember his, like, score? And Emma's like, well, he's got an average of 203 in the last week. Well, that's pretty high. He was one of the last five remaining when we played tag with Sister. He's always looking for you and Norman with Sherry. And I like how Emma's... imagining the two of them looking for them, like, where's Emma? Except this time, they're like, where's Emma? She has a bit of a freak out over it, but Ray just tells her, look, you have to be more suspicious of people, even if you don't want to. Suspect everyone, because this is life or death. I like the little tile page that we've got there of Emma, you know, suspiciously cupping her ear. The series has some really cool cover pages. I like them. We get a flashback to one of their planning sessions, specifically to when Norm proposed that they move in 10 days. And Ray pointed out, like, this is, you know, I don't think this is a smart idea, because her mom's goal is to control us, which means that if we don't make a move, then she won't either. We have all the time in the world to work with. We should be patient and actually figure stuff out. And Ray is like, that's exactly why we should go right now. It's what she won't be expecting. But Norm puts forward, Mom is thinking the same way as you, so we should do this in order to outwit her. He states that... part of the trap that they're in is making them think that they have enough time, so they won't be in a hurry. So, yeah. They should actually work against her plans, is what he is trying to put forward. So the next thing that they're going to try and do is get Donegal to the other two older children on their side. And so they're trying to figure out what they should do. Because they also think, okay, well, what if one of them is Mom's source of information? But Norman says, okay, we'll just deal with that later. And Ray's like, well, what do you mean? What should we do? And he also says, even if they aren't the source of information, I don't know if we can trust them. You know, don't think that everyone's going to believe you as easily as I did. But Norman says, look, even if this doesn't work, if they don't know the truth, then, you know, they might be able to live. And so here's what I'm thinking. Actually, there's a couple little character moments there here and there that I want to point out. You know, the different attitudes that the kids have in terms of telling this secret is pretty interesting. So they go up to Don Gilda in the library and explain, yeah, that our siblings are being sold off to bad people. It's human trafficking. And Don just laughs at this. Come on, stop joking around with me. You know, this is a prank. And then they, of course, are all insistent on it. It's like, oh, come on, you can't be serious. Wait, so you're saying that mom is bad? Yeah, she's the one who's selling it. So are you kidding me? What the hell? I do like that their cover story is pretty much like what is actually happening, but, you know, rooted in reality. It's,
Yeah.
You could pretty much be telling mostly the same story without the demons eating them. And a lot of the would be completely unchanged, honestly.
Yeah, they're really just kind of not knowing that there are demons, and then they place the idea that maybe their friends can still be saved.
Gilda does chime in by saying, you know, Emma loves this place and she loves mom. She wouldn't be making this up. And also, I thought it was weird, you know, when Emma and Norman went to the gate one time. Usually when you break the rules, you know, come clean about it and everything would go back to normal, but you just told us to keep quiet about it. So things have been pretty weird lately, and you've been so serious all this time, and she suddenly breaks down and cries because she's been kind of keeping her own secret in this, but she's been having to deal with it on her own the whole time, and also not knowing the truth because people were keeping secrets from her. So Emma kind of comforts her while this is going on. And meanwhile, Dawn is freaking out over this. So Emma says, look, let's all work together. Let's escape. Let's go help Connie and the others. You know, let's get out of here. And let's also save the people who've been sold off to the human traffickers, even though they're dead. And so they share some more information with them, and they basically say, come on, you should run off before this. Let's figure this out. Ray is actually upset about this approach of, you know, oh, we don't know if they're alive or dead. Oh, let's go save them. He's like, we should have just told them that they were dead. Mm-hmm. But no one's like, nah, that was the easiest way to go about them. And Ray's like, this is too cruel a lie if they aren't the spy, though. You know, having them deal with that information.
Having to have them essentially have their hope shattered.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm really liking Ray as a character because he's got such a blunt approach to things, such a, you know, don't fill people with false hope approach to everything.
He's a realist, but unlike Norman, he wears his heart on his sleeve.
Yeah. And it's weird because you can tell that because they've stated that he's the best strategist. But Norman is seemingly the most manipulative out of all of them. And that plays a big time into this whole conflict, this personal stake he's putting in the conflict between himself and mom in, you know, I've got to outwit her. I've got to win this chess game type of thing. We get a bit of a montage of Emma talking with Gilda. Having, you know, bonding over everything and after having shared this secret, and she thinks to herself, now we can fight together. But then in the middle of the night, Gilda gets up and leaves the room, which makes Emma feel like, she's the traitor. And then finally we're let in on the scheme that the three kids hatched, which was, we're gonna actually test if they're the source of information. We'll lay a trap and we'll tell them where the rope is hidden, which will be a lie. We're going to tell different locations, each to Dawn and Gilda, where I've hidden fake ropes. And then we're just going to figure out, okay, you know, which ropes got taken from there or which ones got discovered. And then we'll, of course, know how mom has found out about it. And then we'll be able to decide if Dawn or Gilda are our enemies.
Just like when Kim Kardashian released her first baby photo.
What the fuck?
She released all of her friends. She gave them a different photo of a different baby so she could find who would be the one to leak it to the press first.
That's a bizarrely intelligent idea coming from Kim Kardashian.
This manga's like Kim Kardashian, Nick.
Shut up, Chris. So, it's interesting because we see two things happen simultaneously. We see Gilda going into a room, but then suddenly Krone sneaks up behind her and grabs her by the shoulder and says, I've been waiting for you, Gilda. And Emma has been sneaking on behind her and sees this going on. But then at the same time, we also see a note being slipped into Mom's office that tells them that there's rope in Norman's bed. And that's the information that Dawn had. Mm. So very clearly, Dawn actually, or someone who was listening in, gave away the information that Dawn had. But Gilda was doing something. We just don't know what it was.
Did they actually say that that's the information Dawn had?
Yeah. Norman says flat out, we'll tell them the rope is places to Dawn is behind my bed. To Gilda, it's in the ceiling of the bathroom, the second floor. And the note that Mom has says rope, Norman, bed.
Gotcha.
So that's the information they gave Dawn. We don't say who actually gives the note. So it's possible that, you know, maybe he told some other kid about the secret in order to try and bring them in, and they betrayed it, you know. But Dawn's information went to Mom. Gilda was out and about, and Krohn came across her and apparently waiting to meet with her, or at least catch her, so.
Gotcha. All right, well.
So the mystery continues to unravel.
I'd be lying if I said there wasn't a part of me that was worried. That's like, what if it is Ray? What if Ray, like, I'm worried now, because now I've gotten attached to Ray. And now, like, my paranoia sets in where I'm like, I don't want Ray to turn out to be evil.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, you know, 99.9 repeating percent chance that it's not one of the main three kids. But if it's going to be one of the three of them, it seems like it would be Ray, or it seems like it would be Ray.
Yeah.
Because we've seen inside of Emma and Norman heads too much by this point.
Yeah. So it's interesting. This is a really intriguing chapter because, you know, there's a lot of chapters that jump this week that are kind of built on the idea of like, holy crap, what happens next week sort of thing. Like, you know, being excited for what's going to come next week. But because this is a series that's so much built on just tension and slowly explaining things, that kind of cliffhanger is actually probably more exciting than even the actual next chapter is going to be. Because this is where you get to theorize. This is where you get to bounce ideas back and forth.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty stoked to see about this. Do you want to make any Rolo T Stone Cold Lock of the Centuries of the Weeks?
I'm going to predict that it's not Dawn or Gilda who is the leak.
Okay. I'm going to make a prediction here. This is my Stone Cold Lock of the Century of the Week for this manga. The information that Mom has is actually accurate. It's not fake information that's being given to her. It's not somebody who's sending in, like, one of Norman's lies. The information that she's gained is accurate.
Hmm.
And I feel like she actually does have a step ahead of these kids, even now.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to Red Sprite.
Nick! Don't you mean Dead Sprite?
I gave you a zero on that one. That's acceptable.
Sweet. I'm moving on up. I'm like the Jeffersons.
Chapter 8, The Kingdom of Nalbion.
To the Daedalus apartment in the sky.
Just leave him alone. He'll be back in about a minute. So, yes, this entire chapter takes place pretty much in Nalbion. We get a little bit of an explanation of how Tatsu and company managed to actually get into the country, which is they went over a ridiculous set of storm clouds by using Mono's super awesome special powers to power the ship and just flew all the way up and over it. But the rest of it is catching up with as he returns to the army that he's a part of, and he's being given a hero's welcome. He meets up with their general, Gailman. And they end up having a private conversation, and they, you know, recap how how Alfred was found by the army and taken in and raised by them. And why, and he says, yeah, you know, you took in a total stranger like me, and I'll never forget, you know, my gratitude for the country that took me in. But as soon as he says that, Gamwin says, this country's going to die soon. Any day it's going to happen. We're just going to lose this. Go to Magonia and go to your, because our country is going to face one final push, and we're not going to be able to take them down. And Alfred says, but I'll fight with you. And he's, no, you've done a lot to help us, but we can't win this. You should go to your friends, and you should, because, you know, this is, you're just sealing your own fate if you stay here. But Alfred says, no, I can't do that. I mean, how could I possibly go back and face them? I've just, the only one, I was the only one who's been safe this whole time. I didn't even go out and try to rescue them. And how can I go to them now without by just abandoning you again? They receive word that, Plasma soldiers are coming in, with the new, wave of reinforcements from the enemy. Gamwin says, they're here for you, Alfred. So, well, let's organize our troops for a counterattack. And Alfred's like, I'll go. No, they're a bad match for you. But Alfred says, I'll give my life for this country. I've come to think of you as my father, and I think of the people of this country that accepted me as my family. That is all I have left as a man who has abandoned his friends, and I'll fight for that reason. I will die protecting this country. And he rushes off by himself. And after he departs, Gamwin just says to himself, you should never tell a parent that you'll die.
That is sad.
It's a cool interaction. Mm-hmm. I like the conversation that they have, and I like the conclusion that we get there. We do have there is a little bit more to the chapter as we're introduced to the neural type soldiers, the new Plasbros. But, you know, it's pretty standard. There they are, and they're gonna kick ass. It got through that chapter really quickly, but I did like what there was there.
Yeah, no, I liked what they gave us with Alfred's story and his connection with this country. It's simple, but I feel like it does what it needs to kind of give us interest to this character, what he's been doing, and give us like a small story within this larger world.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Spring Weapon number 1. Astro Boy goes to high school. Okay, done.
That's it. Yeah, that basically is all we need to do. I wasn't planning to talk about it.
No. That kid looks stupid. I do like the fact that he's just called Zero Ichi Namba. His name is just his number. He looks stupid with that fucking face. I know that's the point, but I fucking hate it. Okay. Alright. Toriko.
Don't you mean... Bear with me, Nick.
Oh, that's why you didn't want to talk about Spring Weapon. You didn't have a pun prepared.
Don't you mean... Torsicle? Like the Grim Reaper has?
You emphasized the importance of rhyming Shokugeki with Spookugeki, which, for one thing, doesn't rhyme. And then you go for something that doesn't even approach a rhyme, except that it has a K sound in it.
Sickle? Rico? It kind of works.
No.
Alright, how about this? Alright. Tor trick or treat-o? Done. I'm done. I just dropped that great fucking pun on all of you. I don't need to be doing it. I'm already done. Alright, goodbye everybody. I'm just gonna get out of here because my work's done. Bye.
I mean, it should have probably been Toriko Tree, but whatever. Anyway. Gourmet 391, Acacia versus Toriko. Ichiryu's in fucking center of the earth or something, sees Blue Nitro, sees Froze, I guess? Acacia's fighting Toriko. They're punching each other and causing explosions, and Acacia's eating attacks and stuff. And Toriko challenges Acacia, you know, if you think that you can eat me, then have a taste of this. His mouth, and it bites onto his hand. But of course, he's full of rage, so he's punching him. He also even takes a bite out of Acacia at one point in retaliation. And they're both biting into each other. And finally, Toriko gets blasted up into the sky and has to shake the blast off. But at that moment, the Dragon King appears and starts charging its attack. And Acacia's like, ha, you can't, you don't have enough time to use your breath attack. Wait a minute. Oh no, the Sky Deer's using its back channel! And Guinness also interferes so that he can't dodge it by using his Guinness search. But Acacia, of course, just eats the attacks. His body starts to swell up and starts to more and more resemble Neo's stupid, pimply form.
Yeah, I'm not happy that the form is essentially getting lamer. Like, I like that they were finally moving away from, like, the pimply version and trying to make him something that actually looks cool.
Even his nose is starting to go back, and it's like, God damn it. So, Acacia responds to this combo attack by eating the dragon and the wolf. Just, eat your head, bite your neck off. Meow. Okay, that took care of that. And then he unleashes a breath weapon, which blows off Brunch and Komatsu and Company's legs.
Yeah, just like from the waist down, they're dead.
Not a whole lot, like, even really paid mind to it, honestly. And then he fires eye beams at Coco and Zebra and Sunny and blows them apart.
At this point, it's clear that no one's dying here. Because in quick succession, the two kings, Brunch, Komatsu, the other two chefs, Sunny, Zebra, Coco, and the Monkey King have all been killed. So there's no way every one of those characters is staying dead, because that would be like, that'd be the most depressing ending for Toriko ever. Like, he kills Akashi. He's like, I did it! All my friends are dead.
I mean, I know what the point of this is, which is the follow-up where Pear is freaking out. He's like, oh no, he's just going to eat everyone. And Toriko puts his hand in front of Pear. And he's like, no matter what happens, don't lose hope. Remember, you told me that, Pear. Acacia is giving off a smell that just keeps getting better and better. Just one more hit. I swear we're all going to seat ourselves around a table of hope. Everyone's bringing determination and steadfast resolution. And even Komatsu, who, despite having his lower half blown off, gives Toriko a look of determination. And Toriko says, let's end this, Neo! This is the final full course meal! All of my rage! So, very much convinced, they're all gonna be okay. Because,
I would have liked if while Toriko's doing his speech and he's like, we're all going to seat ourselves around a table of hope, and everyone's bringing determination and steadfast resolution. If Zange was like in the background, like, that doesn't sound like food. You can't eat resolution. Y'all can't eat steadfast determination, Toriko. You're dumb. I brought donuts.
I put Gator on my full course meal.
I brought nuggets to this. Is bear nuggets from Soku?
We're having squirrel for dessert.
Is the bear nuggets from next week's Spookageki no Shoma? I always knew I loved you, Zonke. You keep my puns alive.
I can't help but think that this chapter would have been much more effective if more weight had been placed on the apparent they're gonna die moments, though. Because then Toriko's determination would seem more effective.
It doesn't really feel like there's a whole lot of anything. Because, he goes into this and you'd understand if it's like, yes, all of his rage is going into it because almost every one of his friends has just been killed in front of him. But, as you said, he doesn't even seem angry. He actually has full confidence that they're all going to survive and that we're all going to be seated around a table of hope and that he'll win. So it's like, think to when Goku was fighting Frieza and Krillin gets killed. and how that anger helps him unlock Super Saiyan 2. Like, there's not anything related to that kind of moment right here. There's none of that same feeling of tension or like actual rage in Toriko because he's just so confident already. Like, he doesn't have any worry about Tori or Komatsu and anyone else. And even Komatsu doesn't. Even though half of his body has been blown off, he's still just like, I know you can do it, Toriko. Which is kind of just like a weird thing in general. And sorry, it's just Super Saiyan, not Super Saiyan 2. But, I get that Toriko's always kind of half parody, but it's still that moment of like, it's just like a weird situation to be put in because at this point in time, there's no real emotion at the end of this.
Yeah, imagine if in that moment of the Super Saiyan transformation, you know, Frieza blasts Piccolo and then kills Krillin, and then Goku goes, "Don't worry, Gohan, we'll use the Dragon Balls to get them back." Go on there.
Yeah, and then it's like, whoo. Yeah, it's definitely just that sort of moment where you're like, eh, I mean, I don't know what I'm really supposed to feel. Like, it's also not the only thing at the end of this, because they also show Tepe looking at the ground, and it looks like the Earth's actually finally just breaking apart now. Like, that's been teased for a while, and last chapter seemed to indicate it was happening, but this is actually the first instance we see of it where the ground's, like, literally breaking apart around them. So, I guess there's that to contend with, but yeah, just sort of a strange way to end the chapter. I can't say it's bad. I don't say I don't like it. It's just sort of curious.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's finish off with World Trigger. Chapter 161, Tamakoma Branch, Part 4.
Not even going to give you a chance.
Good. So
don't the, you mean... I ain't going to do it. Just go.
The other members of Tamakoma show up. I love how Reiji suddenly starts acting. He's like, "All right, you guys, whenever you're around, behave yourselves. Oh, Chica, let me fix your collar." Just fussing over them. And he was like, "What the fuck's with him?" Ikonami says, "That happens all the time. Don't worry about it." Yuri arrives along with Michael Cronin from Canada.
Hey, everybody, we're back. Hey, your hoser. Hey, all your hosers, we're back. I brought some Timbits for everyone, don't you know?
Oh, Yuri, this thing about the 12 Ds of Tamakoma. Yeah.
Oh, he turns you all made B rank. Well, that's just swell there.
Oh, it is wonderful. Yuri continues to act like a doofus, Reiji continues to act like a doofus around Yuri. And, Yuma just kind of goes, "Ah, I gotcha." Yuri greets each of the Tamakoma 2 members by name, seemingly having gotten quite a bit of info, from, Konami and company. And, yeah, she introduced herself as Director Rindo's niece, so that's a nice little bit of information, but not nearly the biggest revelation about a Tamakoma 2 member that we get in this, a Tamakoma member, rather, that we get in this chapter. Greetings are exchanged.
I like how Michael's like, "I'm from Canada, as you can tell from the mustache I have not yet fully committed to yet."
He's 32. Where's that mustache?
He's like, "I try to get it in there, but I don't want to force it, yeah? You know,
all the effort goes into this sweet knot top nut, eh?"
I hear it's what all's the rage down here in Hollywood. It's not America, it's Japan. Oh, y'all, Hollywood to me.
Everywhere not in the great Yukon of the North, that's Hollywood, yo.
I love that. People will be angry about us when we do, like, if we ever do any kind of stereotypical joke about any nation, but Canada will never be, like, Canada will never get that egg. Like, Canadians right now,
it's fine.
Like, yeah, they're like, "Oh, that's not what we sound like, eh?" It's never going to be like a Tumblr post created about this. It's like the safe topic. Canadians are just like, "We don't say a boot, eh? You know, we say about pretty much fine."
Hashtag Meepa Lives Mattery.
But then afterwards, I'm like, but not to take away from legitimate crises, hashtag Black Lives Matter, hashtag, and they just continue on for every other group.
All the Lives Matter movements, we understand the trials and tribulations that they're all experiencing, and they're all in our hearts, yo.
Yo. The one Canadian dude who's learned slang. He's like, yo, that's some basic shit, eh?
Rindo shows up with Yotaro, and Michael says, ah, I'm glad to see that you seem to be doing well.
Do the voice, Nick!
I'm glad you seem to be doing well, young master. Yotaro's like, yes, nice work, Conan. Yuri, look, and just suddenly grabs Chika by the arms like, she's going to be my wife! Now, I understand from the follow-up panel that you're just like, oh, but I thought I was your future bride, right? This, you know, it's a running joke between them. But I was just like, wait a fucking second. When did Yotaro have aspirations of being a fucking harem master?
You know what? It's actually something that I think a lot of kids have. Like, they just, like, when you're younger, I feel like you do have that notion, especially if there's, like an older girl that you know, you do just, like, have that, like, idea. Like, and when I grow up, I'm going to marry her.
Right.
It's just Yotaro.
Especially Yotaro
has no filter for himself, so he just speaks out bluntly with everything.
I know it's, in particular in Japan, it seems to be a running joke with younger kids. Like, oh, I'm going to marry you when I get older, you know. But this is so out of nowhere, because, like, this is not something that we've seen from him before. I love that, like, the most realistic reaction we've ever gotten from Chika, the very real surprise, where it's not like, it's just kind of like, what the fuck is this guy going on? Is in this one panel?
Some people are saying that Chika, when Yotaro first met Chika, he said that she could be his wife. So maybe it's like a little bit of a callback to that.
I think that sounds familiar, actually.
But they're also pointing out something more interesting, that wouldn't Rindo and Yotaro be cousins? Yuri and Rindo, Yotaro?
I mean, that's still not something that's too surprising coming from Japan, guys.
Nick? Okay, I think Nick cut out there. So
you motherfucker, Yotaro, she's mine!
Alright.
How dare you want all the women for yourself?
Are you here, Nick?
I'm here.
Okay, you cut out there for a moment.
Oh, okay. Michael introduces himself to Hughes. And he's like, nice to meet you, my son.
That's not what it sounds like, Nick!
Oh, nice to meet you, my son. Is anyone really going to buy that? Oh, you can be my nephew then.
Yes!
He's so tolerating. I guess we don't have to decide on a voice for Michael Cronin whenever we do the next Week in Mock Recap Lizard World Trigger.
Nope, he is decided.
Done and dusted. They start doing a bit of preparation for the next rank wars. Naosama says, yeah, we've got to face Kagura Squad, Azuma Squad, and Suzunari 1. And Shuri points out, well, you fought all of them before. And they also point out, okay, we've got to get 5 more points than Kagura by the time that this is over in the next 2 matches, because Kagura Squad would tie with us, but we lost to them in the last one. So we've got to at least beat them by 5 points in the next 2 matches. But they've got a lot more weapons on their side this time than the last time that they faced each of these teams. They've got Kuga's new techniques, they've got the wire strategy, Chika's lead bullet sniping, and of course Hughes is their new ace. And the rest of it is just a lot of little things, honestly, until this one final revelation that we get at the end. But Cronin takes off Hughes to get his trigger set decided on. Shiori has a little bit of a discussion with Osamu, where Osamu says, "Yeah, I'm gonna be attending high school coming up soon." And Shiori's like, "Oh, you're gonna stay here then? Yeah, if you let me, that'd be great." Because he decided to live at the Tomoko Branch because it's the headquarters, and also to the school that they're going to. Tika's talking about joint sniper training, and Yuri says, "Oh, you want to help me prepare Osamu's room for so he can stay here?" And Tika's like, "Sure."
It was a really weird, normal chapter. It's so
weird for a shonen manga to have this kind of conversation.
Yeah, they're like, "Hey, do you want to help me clean up this room?" Absolutely. It's like, okay.
Are you going to flip the beds over brutally?
She's like, "No, but we will turn them because you need to turn your mattress every couple months." I'm like, did this become a WikiHow article?
I mean, it's not that, she's agreed to help the room. It's that when My Hero Academia had the, "Oh, let's show off, our rooms to each other so we can get to know each other better." It was like, "Let's have a competition to see."
Yeah, or it was wacky. Like, they were, going into each other's rooms and, pulling things.
"Oh, my God, it's so plain in here! Oh, my God, there's literally nothing in this room!
Yeah.
There's so much cake everywhere! Oh, my God, Tokuyami, you're such a goth nerd!"
Yeah, no, it's,
honestly, this chapter did a surprising amount to endear Chika to me. Like, she's always just been kind of the girl who makes that face, but it's so weird. I don't know, having her have these very human interactions with people makes her seem so much more of a character. Reiji is, Yuri's like, "Oh, hey, Reiji, help out too." "Yes, of course!" And she just kind of, looks at him.
Yeah.
And Reiji's like, "What?"
It's nice seeing her, actually kind of, hint that she's in the know that he's definitely got a crush on Yuri. Just seeing that is kind of funny, because you don't normally see Chika have any kind of cheekiness.
Coyness.
Honestly, you don't see anything like that. Especially not towards other people, so it's just kind of funny seeing that. Like, she's not teasing him or anything, but she's definitely like, "I see you got a crush on her."
"You like Krabby Patties, don't you, Squidward?"
I thought that was her name for Yuri's test. I was like, "Damn, Chika, that's filthy." She's like, "It's okay. I like Krabby Patties too. Wink."
"That special sauce, but you gotta put the meat between the buns. Oh my God, Chika, you are filthy!"
She's like,
"Oh, I always thought you were the most innocent Shonen Jump." Chika's like, "You don't know what books I keep under my mattress."
She's like, "Why haven't you ever asked my full name? Chika Saget." Like, oh, it all makes sense now.
Get all flattened out from the drawer, stab her eye out with it. Oh my God!
I like this chapter a lot. Oh, I guess we should have mentioned that
there's a little bit more, yeah. We get Hughes choosing his trigger set. He expresses particular interest in Escudo, the shield that comes out of the ground that Torimaru used in that one rank war in the battle that he witnessed during the invasion of name the Tardor down, sorry. But Cronus pointed out, I was like, "Well, I don't know, it's kind of an outdated trigger. It uses a lot of Tryon," and he was like, "No, I'm trying to think of what Tamakama 2 lacks." Oh, and there's little details here and there, he was like, "Jin used that shield too. You could ask him to teach you." And he was like, "I don't want to learn anything from that guy. Fuck that asshole. Holding my trigger hostage. Fuck him." But yeah, Hughes decides on his set, but he's actually got only 7 of 8 slots, filled out. He could use one more. He's like, "Eh, I don't need any more." And then he says to Yuma, "Hey, help me do a test run." He was like, "Cool."
Yeah.
Yuri, they finish preparing Osamu's room. Chika goes to presumably watch Hughes and Yuma practice. And Yuri is like, "Oh, yeah, Osamu, here's your new room, and if you haven't found anything in here that was left by the previous occupant, you know, don't worry about it. And Osamu's like, previous occupant? Who's using the room before? And he looks up at the door, and there's a name tag that's still on it. It reads, Kido.
Dun, so, dun, dun.
Commander Kido, the scar-faced, most antagonistic person in Border, used to be a Tamakoma member, which is a surprising little revelation, which I hope we learn a bit more about.
It doesn't necessarily mean that. It could be a member of his family.
It's true.
Remember, this seems like a group that's been around for a while and is a group that supports aligning themselves with neighbors. So it's possible that one of his family members also did so. Left, got kidnapped, was taken, whatever, because of that, and that's why Commander Kido seems so against it.
Annalisa is in the chat, she's freaking out. Kido!
It'd be interesting to see. I'm curious to see what the fallout from that is.
Yeah, but,
More than that, I really like the battle we're going to be getting. This seems like an interesting...
Hughes and Yuma,
but then we have Kagayura Squad, Azuma Squad, and Tsuzunari 1. So these are all big groups.
Rematch, yeah.
Two of them are a rematch from the match they lost, and Tsuzunari 1 probably had the biggest singular member that they fought in lower-ranked matches. So it's going to be really curious. And I'm going to make my Stone Cold Lock of the Century of the Week on World Trigger now. Hughes ends up going one-on-one against Ko and loses. And that's why they established earlier on that he's around rank 6 in attackers. And Ko, as you remember, is ranked 4th. So Ko is better than him.
Well, and also recall that those matches were exclusively with swords. Mm-hmm. So...
Well, Ko also fought with a sword. Sword and shield, but yeah, still sword.
Well, I mean, without any additional stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, when Ikoma actually whipped out his special technique, he couldn't really do anything against it, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting stuff going on. It's always unfortunate when we have these chunks occasionally where it's like, well, all the chapters in Jump are kind of the same. And that they're building up to something exciting that'll happen soon, instead of something exciting happening now. And then we'll blow our load probably all at once a couple of weeks from now. That said, it's time to do our MVPs and Series of the Week. I am going to go ahead and go with Promised Neverland, because it suits the series best to have this type of chapter. I was definitely the most on the edge of my seat for it. World Trigger had some nice moments here and there, honest, and I did like it overall. I liked the stuff we got from Amalgam of Destruction. Like, there wasn't a chapter that I, like, disliked, honestly. But in terms of stuff to write home about, I mean, Promise Neverland is what takes it for me. And I took it for the chat, too, although it was very close
this
week.
Yes, I was actually just about to look to see. I also gave it Promise Neverland. Promise Neverland, I think, had a great... It was literally, as the point I was saying that, it was 1 point separating Promised Neverland from My Hero. So, don't let anyone tell you differently, guys. Your vote matters. One vote is what decided who the audience picked as the best this week. And for those of you who are listening to the podcast after the fact, either on YouTube or grabbing the MP3 off of Podbean or iTunes, I try to have the poll up every Monday night. So it's hitbox.tv/RollOT. So even if you can't make it live, you can still vote for what you thought your favorite chapter this week was. So you can still put your vote in there, even if you're already able to join us for the live show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me get his name down real quick. My weekly MVP is going to be Galeman from Red Sprite.
Oh, okay.
I just like the interaction that he has with Alfred, especially that last line that he delivers. About, you know, turning the whole thing on its head that Alfred is trying to do.
Yeah, I could dig that. I'm actually give mine to Ray, even though he didn't do anything like individually special this week. This was just a week where I became very aware of how much I enjoyed him, and I liked what we got of him in this chapter, what we saw of him and how we're seeing his personality develop further and further.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, that's going to do it, guys. We're going to finish up weekly manga recap here. So thank you everybody for joining us. We tend to do the show Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right around there. But sometimes we do need to change things up. Skype doesn't work, or the stream doesn't work. We have to move off of somewhere aside from hitbox.tv/reloadc, for example. To stay updated on all that stuff, you can follow us on Twitter. You can follow the podcast itself at WMR Podcast, and you can follow the host individually at RoloT and at Y Ruler of Time, and we'll let you know when the podcast is going to begin. Check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. Subscribe to us on YouTube. Subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you do on iTunes, be sure to leave a comment or rating so that you can help us beat the woodworkers.
Yes. I feel one day we're going to reach that lofty goal.
Not if you keep on making stupid Halloween puns. All right.
I'll have you know, I just put up a poll on the Weekly Manga Recap Twitter. So twitter.com/WMRpodcast, where you all get to vote for what your favorite Halloween pun was this week. And I at Shonen Jump, so I hope they respond as well. Votes are already coming in, Nick. This may be more important than our election this year.
Send your criticism. Ask us questions. Suggest future manga for us to read. Send that stuff via email to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. And I'm going to have our next suggestion at the end of this whole tirade, so be sure to stay tuned in. Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. You guys allow us to do all sorts of fun bonus stuff for you guys to enjoy. We love putting it all together. We just did our Q&A episode for the month of October, and we're going to try and pump something out as well this weekend, because we got a bit of ground to make up yet. So keep an eye out. I think we'll probably do our stream, I think, this weekend. Does it sound...
Yeah, well, we have two we have to do, I think.
We gotta do two, so I think we better do one of them this weekend.
Yeah.
Stay tuned on that.
Actually, I was waiting for it to load up. We got a new review from Lizzie Lump, who's gave us a 5-star review, says, "By golly, this podcast is swell."
By golly.
By golly, this podcast is swell. So thank you, Lizzie Lump. It is greatly appreciated. It's because of your work that we climb another inch forward on our Everest that is Beating the Woodworking Podcasts.
Thanks go out to the people who help put the podcast together, such as Steve Mann, our title card artist. You can see his artwork right up there. You can check out his artwork in a number of different places. He draws boobs. In fact, his Tumblr is I Draw Boobs. One of his Tumblrs. He's got a couple of them. He's in a lot of places, is what I'm saying. He's also got his own Patreon, patreon.com/Steve Mann. You can check out. And I believe that he actually puts all of the title cards for previous episodes on his different sites for people to check out if you want to actually see the full versions of the images that we put up here.
Yes, or if you want to use any of them as like desktop backgrounds, things like that. I know we had that.
I mean, I know you guys want to see Obama's bulge. You know,
he had an uncensored version as well for those who really legitimately wanted to see Obama's bulge.
And if the male form is not your thing, it's like, you know, I prefer the ladies. Trust me, he's got you covered. Infamous Planet, of course, thanks as well, because everything aside from our faces and Steven's artwork that you see, that's all him putting that together. So thank you very much, man.
Yes.
All right. The next series that we're going to cover is something that I'm not sure if it would actually qualify as a horror manga, but it's also older than a lot of the series that we tend to cover on the show. So this is a suggestion. It came to us. Do I have the email up still? Let me go grab it real quick while I continue speaking in order to buy time in order to get it. This comes from Rotten Butter, who recommends to us Devilman, the 70s series.
Oh, yeah.
We should be able to, I think we'll be able to get it all done in time for next week. From everything I'm looking, for those of you not familiar with it, it's about a guy who becomes possessed by a demon and essentially becomes a dark superhero. But from the impression that I've gotten, it's more a superhero in the anime. So we'll see how the manga plays out. We'll see how it goes. It's gonna be interesting to take a look at another older series. We've only covered a few from this time period in the past. But, yeah, this is what we're going to do next time, and, it's,
All right, boosh. Gonna end this off with a fucking classic. It's nice. You dig that. All right. Any last thoughts, then, we want to share before we head off?
Honestly, I'm just like, I think that I'll just keep on talking so that you can't fit another pun in anywhere in this thing.
I've already started preparing for next week.
No.
I already have some.
You need to stop, Chris.
Next week.
You're bad with power.
Next week is going to be it's going to be our Halloween-y episode. It's going to be the Halloween episode. Okay?
Right, because there's not going to be any more October after next
week. So next week's when all of my theatrics are coming out. I'm not gonna mince words here. I'm gonna try to get costumes. I'm gonna try to have special effects for next week, and I'm gonna have a pun for every series. And Nick, I need you to grade them. I'm not asking for much from you, but you need to grade each one of them. And by the end of it, we're going to settle what is the best Halloween pun, and you're gonna be blown away. I feel if you do it on a scale from 1 to 10, I'm not going to give you one that isn't at least a 6. That's what I think will be the lowest one.
So I've got to be like a Dancing with the Stars judge?
Yes. Like you're going to judge not just on creativity, it's going to be on delivery, it's going to be on general rhythm, flow, kind of spitting exactly, you know, like a rapper would. I'm going to bring it like I'm Eminem. Like, I'm just going to come in and just start rattling them off. And you're going to be like, wow, this wordplay, this lyrical mastery, where did this come from? And you're going to be like, oh, right. That's my best buddy, Chris. Dropping puns.
So like, look forward to next week's Weekly Manga Recap. Chris will be doing the show by himself, guys. See you then.
I'm just going to have a second camera with a sock puppet with a pair of glasses taped to it. Like, Nick, didn't you like that?
That one was great, Chris!
Didn't you like that pun, Nick? Dead sprite? You're like, well, Chris, you're so funny, and I'm gonna try to make out with you. I'm like, no, Nick, you have a girlfriend.
I don't care, I love you!
Nick, no. No.
Oh, God, Nick, you're insatiable.
I'm just gonna start sucking everything around here.
I just have nothing but phallic.
That's your problem for not keeping away from me. Yeah, I'm like, oh, something phallic.
I'm like, Nick, stop this, please.
Control yourself, please. Have some dignity.
Keep it together.